First of all, by the way, if you see me fiddling with my glasses, it's because I had a little accident with them about 10 minutes ago. And so if you see me struggling around on the floor looking for them, it might be because they've fallen off the end of my nose. I'm going to start with a brief test to see how well you know your clichés, by which I mean those overused sayings with which we constantly communicate folk wisdom to one another. So join with me now as we play Name That Cliché. And the first one is for the guys here, really, mainly. Imagine you're at a wedding buffet and you've piled your plate up much too high with a mixture of sherry trifle and banoffee pie, just as I saw Andrew doing at a function recently. And before you're halfway through it, you know you're not going to be able to finish that plateful. And your mum or your wife turns to you with that well-known, only too familiar, judgmental look on her face. And she says what? Yeah, thank you. Your eyes are big in the belly. 1,500 hits on the Google search engine, so it's a pretty familiar expression, that one. Number two. Your friend is caught in the middle of a painful conflict. She urgently needs to make clear which side she's on, but she refuses to commit herself. In the end, you get fed up with her hesitation and you say, thank you. With 12,300 hits on Google, don't sit on the fence. And number three, finally, you're chatting to your friends and the conversation turns to somebody who's accumulated a fabulous amount of wealth, like, for example, Bill Gates. Somebody said they'd love to have that kind of money, and you say, rather primly, you can't take it with you. 1.75 million hits on Google. So it's quite a familiar turn of phrase. Now, the fact that everyone here pretty well is familiar with these sayings means, I'm afraid, there's not going to be many surprises in what I say this evening. But the thing about folk wisdom is that it lacks authority. It doesn't call people to change the way they live. But when it's Jesus Christ himself who is speaking, and speaking about the bedrock values of Christianity, then there is considerably more of a challenge to each one of us. We're continuing the journey through Matthew's gospel that we started several months ago, and we've reached the exact middle of the Sermon on the Mount. In this famous passage, which spans the whole of chapters 5 to 7 of Matthew's Gospel, Jesus has led his followers up onto a hillside and is lecturing them about the spiritual and moral values of the new social order that he has come to establish. Jesus calls this new society the Kingdom of Heaven. But these chapters are not just a picture of what life will be like when we get to heaven. On the contrary, they tell us how we should be living here and now in the light of the glory that we can look forward to in heaven. And so, Jesus deals in the Sermon on the Mount, one by one, with all the kinds of behavior that can make or break our relationships with God and one another. Anger, adultery, divorce, revenge, hypocrisy, forgiveness. And then he comes to one of the areas of the Christian life that I and many others find hardest to bring under God's sovereignty, the area of wealth. And Jesus' first point about wealth is related to the last and most familiar of those phrases that we thought about earlier. You can't take it with you. Of course, Jesus expresses that truth in an infinitely more serious and profound way, but in essence, he answers the same unspoken question. What should be our attitude to wealth as Christians? And his answer is, It is futile and harmful to accumulate more possessions than we can use. Look down with the Bible in your laps, please, at chapter 6, verse 19. Jesus says, "Do not store up for yourself treasures on earth, where moth and rust consume, and where thieves break in and steal." And he continues, "Store up for yourself treasures in heaven," and his reason that you see in verse 21, and we'll come on to that in more detail in a moment, "Where your treasure is, there will your heart be also." Many of you will know that as a former banker, I have worked with many people whose hearts were tied up with their wealth. At the end of a long day looking after other people's money, they'd spend the evening looking after their own, speculating on the stock exchange, buying and selling houses, even acting as paid consultants, making no time for spiritual growth, no time even in many cases for their families. Some of them found my evening job, training for unpaid Christian ministry, quaint and even laughable. But these words of Jesus reinforce my confidence that those who put service to Christ before material gain are going to be happier in the long run. And don't think it's harder for us to follow this teaching than it was for the people of Jesus' day. Yes, we do live in a materialistic age, but then so did Jesus. In fact, the Pharisees and the Sadducees, the two most influential Jewish sects of Jesus' day, seem to have believed that material prosperity was God's reward to them for living sinless lives. In contrast, they thought, if you were poor and hungry, it had to be because you were a sinner. Perversely then, to them, wealth served actually as a badge of spiritual status. And Jesus utterly rejects that system of values. The moths and the rust in verse 19 symbolize a general flaw with wealth. Of course, there may well have been people who accumulated iron goods and fabrics that could rust or get moth-eaten in storage. But the point Jesus is making is surely a broader one. Wealth is untrustworthy. It can let you down, as so many people in Britain know only too well today. In fact, just lately, with the signs of an economic recession looming, investors have seen billions wiped off the shares of their investment portfolios. Some of last year's highest earners in the city are out now looking for work or trying to downsize their homes or to cash in other investments in a market where there are already more sellers than buyers. And if your heart is tied up with these unreliable treasures, then your heart is going to get broken. And the saddest of all will be those who leave it too late to try something different. Those who realize, perhaps literally on their deathbed, that they can't take it with them. Those to whom God will say, in the words of a different parable, "You fool. This very night your life is demanded of you. And the goods you've accumulated, whose will they be now?" There is another way, says Jesus. Verse 20, if you'd look at it, please. "Store up for yourself treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust consumes, and where thieves do not break in and steal." So how can we store up riches in heaven? Here are just two suggestions. It could mean taking our eyes off wealth creation, perhaps initially just for a day a week, as some of our lay ministers here have already done, and focusing on growth targets of a different sort. For others, they may may lay up treasures in heaven through the way they use the wealth that God has given them. Spending more on others. Giving rather than spending. Giving rather than saving. Just as one example, many people here at All Saints and St. Richard's were richly blessed by the sacrificial giving that made this church building possible. Many here have already encountered immense joy by sponsoring a child in a poor part of the world or by supporting one of our own mission partners. And whether in the end it's by turning our energies away from wealth creation and towards serving God, or whether it's by deploying our wealth in God's service, Jesus promises an eternal joy that no thing and no one can spoil for us. Store up treasures in heaven where, he says, neither moth nor rust consumes, and where thieves do not break in and steal. Now in verses 22 and 23, In verses 22 and 23, Jesus seems at first sight to change the subject because he starts to talk about eyes rather than treasure. In point of fact, he is still on the same topic, and we'll come back and look at the relevance of those two verses in a moment. But for now, would you please jump forward to verse 24? Because this answers a crucial question. And that question is, what are the consequences for those who ignore the first part of this passage? For those who try to be good Christians, but continue to put their trust in material wealth? And Jesus' answer was foreshadowed in another common metaphor that we looked at earlier. You won't be able to sit on the fence forever. Look at verse 24. Jesus says, no one can serve two masters. For a slave will either hate the one and love the other, or be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth. Now, thankfully, we're not familiar in this country with the dynamics of slavery, but perhaps somebody else here has shared my experience, the experience that I had once in the career in finance I referred to earlier, where I did have to serve two masters for a time. I was seconded to a specialist trading desk with instructions to put proper credit controls in place. And if you know anything about the city, you'll know that that would have been anathema to the trading desk. And for a while, I had to report to the heads of those two departments, trading and credit, who had vastly different agendas. And as you can imagine, it was an intensely charged political situation in which I could never serve or the interests of both simultaneously, where I could never keep the trust of both simultaneously. And at first, my loyalty to those two guys swung backwards and forwards, but quite quickly, and exactly as Jesus describes, I began to despise one of those masters. I won't say which. In the same way, says Jesus, you cannot serve both God and wealth. Now, he may well have been directing his wrath primarily at those wealthy religious classes I spoke about earlier, who saw their prosperity as a sign that God was pleased with them. But the warning applies just as urgently to us. And I'm going to be a bit of a language anorak here. The Greeks had several everyday words for wealth, but the word Jesus uses here is mammonas, mammon. You may know the phrase, the temple of mammon, written in English as a proper name with a capital M. It may suggest that Jesus saw wealth not just as a thing, but as a principle, a kind of idol, perhaps even a kind of entity that will try to bend our will to its own agenda, that will try to compete with God for our loyalty. And whether you take that literally or not, the Bible's intention here is quite unmistakable. God and mammon, or wealth, are in competition. They have rival claims on each one of us. And eventually, one or other will win, says Jesus, the tug of war. If you're fortunate, God will eventually win you over, and you'll begin to despise your old rival boss, money. But if you're unfortunate, money will draw you further and further away from God until, to your eternal sorrow, you end up hating him. And so to recap. Firstly, the Christian's attitude to wealth should be not to accumulate it, but to use it to advance God's kingdom. And secondly, if we keep serving wealth, it will draw us away from God. But that leaves a question unanswered. What is in those two verses we've skipped over? Verses 22 to 23, where Jesus talks about eyes. Let's read the verses. Verse 22, the eye is the lamp of the body. So if your eye is healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is unhealthy, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light in you is darkness, how great is the darkness? Now the meaning of these verses has been hotly debated, and it's here that my analysis is most tentative. However, I think Jesus is making clear just why our attitude to wealth is such a critically important issue for our spiritual state. And what he seems to be saying is that our attitude to wealth colours and has the potential to corrupt our entire outlook on life. You see, when we talk about healthy eyesight, we generally talk in purely physical terms. Short-sighted, long-sighted, astigmatism, that sort of thing. But when Jesus talks about healthy eyesight, he's talking in moral terms. Let's look closely at the two words that are translated healthy and unhealthy. As you may know, many words in New Testament Greek don't have a single straightforward equivalent in modern English. The word translated here as healthy literally means single, but elsewhere in Matthew and in Paul's epistles, the same word is used in places to mean generous. And the word here rendered as unhealthy generally means grudging. Elsewhere in Matthew and in Mark, the phrase a grudging eye actually means covetousness, the urge to possess the things that we see. And this is controversial, maybe, but if this interpretation is correct, it would give a clear and coherent meaning which fits perfectly with the verses before and after. If your eye is generous, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is grudging or covetous, you will be full of darkness. Look, our eyes are the most direct instrument we have for making sense of the world about us. And if we look out at the world through our eyes with envy and desire, then the very light by which we perceive the world becomes little more than an instrument of temptation. And Jesus rather ominously adds, if then the light in you is darkness, how great is the darkness? In contrast, if we look out on the world with a generous eye, we will constantly be detecting opportunities to use what we have to serve God and to help other people. In that way, says Jesus, we will lay up untarnishable treasures in heaven. In this life, we'll have a foretaste of the joy and the peace of heaven. And one day, we'll be able to look back from the perspective of eternity and see that we have used the material gods that God, the material gifts that God entrusted to us to push forward the boundaries of the kingdom that Jesus has called into being through his teaching and through his blood. Let's bow our heads in prayer.